into some questions for John and how his church has shaped, been shaped by this. How is your church maybe unique or different because this is the food that folks are, this is the perspective, right? This is the lens at which people are looking at stuff, and then we go wherever people want to go.
Heads up on the question right there.
There it was. It was a general Q&A. And then maybe some, we'll just see what people want to do, maybe some preaching questions towards the end or some church service questions. Yeah? So, Paul, you want to just kind of take it away and we'll...
Well, I want to begin by saying that, I've known John for a few years now. We met because we were both sharing on a board. And it wasn't, when I first heard about John, it wasn't uncommon for, because of various technologies, for churches to be, incorporating movies into their messages and this kind of thing. And often in many evangelical churches, that kind of thing was done kind of like a bait and switch. Like, here's a movie that you know, so you come and see the movie. And, then here's the gospel at the end so your soul can go to heaven when you die. And what I very quickly saw with John was that was in no way what he was doing. He was doing something very different. There are others who, when they listen to John, get concerned. What do you mean you're preaching? What do you mean you're preaching the gospel from what we learned from a plumber? Isn't the gospel from the Bible? And so as the more I got to know John and read his book and listened to him, they podcast their sermons. You can download the sermons. You can watch them on YouTube. You discover that in many ways what he was doing is taking general revelation seriously. And general revelation is this world that God made. And Christian theology has said, God made this world and it is good and he wants it. And in fact, the gospel, we talked about that a little bit in our preaching class, is the gospel for squirrels? And I said, yes, the gospel is for squirrels. And you might say, well, how is the gospel for squirrels? They can't, if they come to the front of church, they can't pray the sinner's prayer. The gospel is for squirrels because the gospel is the renovation of heaven and earth. Mm-hmm. And so the squirrel declares the glory of God by being a squirrel. And so what I see, John doing is basically helping us flesh out the manifest wisdom of God as declared by the work that he does. And we're included in this. And that's a vitally important thing that the church needs. I think there are reasons why preachers and theologians get nervous about this, and we can talk about some of those, but I think it has everything. I think you look at the person who's doing it and listen to them long enough and understand their heart and say, no, John isn't just some pantheist who's going on about this and that. He's saying things that we've said all along the way. I see God when I go to work. I see God when I look at other people. I see God all over the place because his fingerprints are on everything. So, again, kind of listening to you today, I think, if we watch some, theologians are always careful about language. And I think, again, if we recognize that Scripture is canon, but that God, in fact, inspires lots of things, it doesn't mean that Scripture isn't special or doesn't fulfill a special role in our life. It means that, it is part of the story. And I personally have greatly benefited from watching how John, watching what John does. And why I think this is so vitally important, like I said earlier, God makes Adam and Eve. He doesn't set them on a rock and say, okay, now look at me. Clap for me. Praise me. He makes a couple of gardeners and says, get to work. Well, what are they doing when they're working? Or they're making a living so God will feed them? No. They're doing the will of God as they're gardening because he loves the plants. He loves the animals. He loves the earth. This is all what he loves. And so work and worship are one. And ideally, that's how it's supposed to be. And I think what John is doing is helping us see God is speaking to us all over the place. Are we listening? So I really appreciate what you do, John. And if you have critics, you send them my way. And I'll have your back. And I think what you're helping us see is very, very important. And it's deeply reformed. And I think the world needs more of it. So that's
well, if you're going to do just like a minute and a half version for those of us who might not remember some of the contours of special revelation. So we're talking about general revelation, right? But just so people, I mean, sometimes it's helpful just to have a couple of theological. So talk about verbal and plenary and some of the, can you do that?
Well,
I'm not looking for a long thing. It's kind of a segue in that.
The heavens declare the glory of God. I like to get into little conversations with bloggers, and there's this woman in Texas that got some publicity recently because she has a blog, Raising Kids Without Religion. And so I put a comment on her blog, basically, what is the ocean for? And what do you mean, what is the ocean for? What is the ocean for? If there is no God, the ocean can't tell you what it's for. Special revelation helps tell us what the ocean is for. The ocean is for the glory of God. And the creation is for the glory of God and the enjoyment of God by the creation and through the creation. And so special revelation fills out the picture. But it fills out the picture of all the rest of Revelation. I don't know if that's the tree you're looking to bark up.
Not exactly, but that's okay.
Well, why don't you say what you're thinking about?
So just because John's here, why don't we just do what I thought your thought was, have a conversation with John about, it's a unique situation, right?
Do I have to move up there?
No, well, Paul can stay up there, and you can stay up there. So you can maybe join him up there. So how is your church unique, do you think, John? Or maybe you say, well, it's not really, because you've been preaching this way since the beginning, or?
No, we started off as a seeker-sensitive Willow Creek church.
Okay.
So if you're part of the church planting parlance, you know what that means. And so we were doing the bait and switch. hook them with relevance.
Talk about that a little bit, because you did it in a unique way. You thought the sermon was the most seeker-friendly thing that happened, so you went bam to the sermon right away.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
you didn't have 30 minutes of warm-up, as it was kind of press.
That might have been more ego than it was.
But that's how you did it. Yeah. That was your take on it, right?
That is how we did it initially, because singing required people to believe in the words that they were singing. So why would you make them sing a song that... So we took the seeker-sensitive thing to the
purists.
Nth degree. We were purists in the worst sense of the word. We hid all our holy things. We didn't do baptisms at church. We didn't do communion. We did that in a separate service. And it was like a secret seeker society, right? And so we did that for 5 or 6 years. But then you get into a bit of a problem because you've got all these seekers who have now become Christians. So you've got Christians in the community who need X, and you're still talking to seekers with the relevant cultural thing. Who are you talking to, right? And how do you do both, right?
Right.
So what we're doing now, it crept up on us. The staff didn't say, okay, let's try this idea.
Let's turn a corner here.
All the theology that I'm citing now, this history that Paul so rightly says we're so rich in, I was scrambling for after doing what we're doing and looking for some theological rationale for this. We went to a meeting with Neil Planting on Richard Mound, California in 2005, and we had collectively as a group of churches in Calgary preached on the Lord of the Rings as the three movies came out. And after doing that, we got to a point during one of the meetings where Phil Reinders, one of the pastors, said, I just hate having to break up the Lord of the Rings and make it fit into a gospel story, a biblical passage. And he asked the question first. He said, do you think we could turn it around and like let the Lord of the Rings narrative lead and then kind of weave the biblical stuff in, but let it be the lead narrative, right? And we all sort of talked quietly and decided we would do that. And we did that, and it was a huge smash all over the media, and all kinds of stuff resulted from that. But then that brought up the question. Okay, so what is it about Lord of the Rings truth and the God things that are happening there, and how authoritative is that, and can we do that? And so we went and met with Neil and Rich and asked those questions. And I still remember Neil Planiga when we asked that specific question, leaning forward on the boardroom table and hitting his fist and saying, if it's God's truth in general revelation, then it's fully authoritative. And he's right. Whether we can see it as clearly, is it as perspicuous, as knowable, as close as special revelation in the Bible? I don't think so. I mean, the different language, all the things we talked about this morning, but that it's authoritatively from God and from God's voice, and therefore authoritative, yeah, that isn't, you can't argue that. And that, I can still feel the vibration of the table, because it's been vibrating through our church community, and in me, and not in the others, incidentally. Like the other pastors, you know, they all kind of give us a nod at New Hope, and yeah, that's John's thing, dog on a bone. He won't let go of that. some of them, we just talked about it last week, I was telling them about my unofficial heresy trials at Calvin, and they're all going, well, that's not true. You know, and the one guy who was trying to comfort me says, you know, it's not true, they don't know you, right? And I don't think you're heretic. He says, I think this is totally unwise what you're doing.
You're not a heretic, you're just a fool.
Call me a heretic.
At least I stand a chance with a heretic.
Fool.
Heretics, I know. They write books about fools, not so much.
Anyway, we moved at that moment of realizing, okay, that there's maybe more authority there than we ever thought, and that it's God's authority, from using all of that cultural stuff as illustration and as a source of relevance to using it as a source of revelation. So we moved all the same things. It looked almost exactly the same, yet something fundamental had changed. And that's the time where I write in the book that half the people in the church went, something's changed here. And they knew it intuitively. And they told me something changed before I knew it had changed. But I was spending more time with the illustration. I was listening to the illustration more. I was submitting to the voice and behind. I didn't even know I was doing these things. But people were noticing that I was increasingly treating it as a lowercase t text and having it converse and co-illumine and speak back to the scriptural text. And then vice, you know, that dialogue was happening. And they, half of them left, right, at that point.
Why?
A variety of reasons. You're a heretic. You've thrown the Bible out. I've had people from other Baptist churches who come to our church and go, man, I love New Hope. So biblical. More biblical than any church I've ever gone to. And yet a whole bunch of people thought we were turfing it because we spend... I mean, there are those who are critics who have listened to multiple sermons and measured how much time I spend talking about Hugo, how much time I spent talking about biblical references, how many times I name Jesus, how many times I explicitly say the gospel. So there is a mindset that says, you know, unless it's mostly biblical most of the time, there's an even stronger mindset that says unless you start with the biblical text, which ultimately I'm doing every single time because I only know Jesus through how I came to know him through the Bible, and it's the lens through which I'm viewing the world. But on any given Sunday, I start, well, this Sunday, because I'm here, I didn't know, so I started with the biblical text. But we start with the creation text, and I'm good with that because I trust that I this is really biblically based. But when people hear that, like, when's he going to get to the Bible? When's he going to get to God? And many of those people who left could not hear the voice of God through the creational text, ever. There was just no, and you don't fault somebody for that. Like, some people left going, I just can't. I don't get it. And then others left saying, I can't go there. This is way too out of control. You're going to have God speaking in all of the, like, at least with my Bible. And I don't even spend enough time with that, but at least I can hold it in my hand. They didn't say that. But this is way too out of control if you're going to start to believe in a God whose voice could be discerned everywhere.
I imagine, though, is it true that, I mean, the people who leave because of that have some kind of grid for church in their... These are not the folks that you
reached out to who are unchurched or who have a pretty irreligious kind of experience before they come to, it's folks with a church experience, right?
Yeah, most of the others have stayed.
Yeah. Now, I have to imagine you have to have a grid in your head beforehand that would prevent you from seeing the new way.
Yeah. But the problem is with the newbies who come in and come to faith there. And this is a big challenge for what the shape of this church is going to be. They don't have all of that biblical experience that I'm bringing with a seminary education and a whole bunch of people who come from churches and come to New Hope can bring to this. They don't have that grid through which to engage their world. And so by preaching on any given Sunday out of your 30 minutes of sermon, 30 minutes going to be okay for Sunday?
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. I mean, this point if it's not 50, but
no, it'd be 30. When you're doing half electrician stuff, which just sounds like electrician stuff, if you're not hearing the other stuff, and then half Bible stuff, how do you disciple and nurture and grow people in biblical knowledge? This worldview requires diving in 100% into knowing your Bible yourself. And as a faith community, and it introduces this huge other book with multiple chapters in multiple languages that we're asking you to engage in as well. And so I, tongue-in-cheek, always go, it's like this idea would require giving your whole life up in order to do it.
So do you have Bible studies? Do you have, how do we fill that in?
We do, I wish there was more buy-in. This is what scares me a little bit.
Never near.
Yeah, I know, every church, right? Why don't people read their Bibles as much or come to class? I mean, I tell one story, and it's a great story, but it's not normative. But a guy who comes to faith during a sermon series on Bach, an Advent series, and Bach and the Bible. I should always, part of why I get in trouble is because of the language I use. I call it a text. I say co-illumination, which infers equality. I say we're preaching an electrician. It's hyperbole. It's designed to piss them off. A little bit. But
so you're somewhat successful.
The word highly, maybe.
Where was I going? What was I saying?
You're talking about Bach.
Bach. Oh, yeah. Okay, so he comes to faith 6 months in. He's like growing like crazy, and he says, I need a Bible study so that I can have more with which to see God in my life. Mm-hmm. And so we had a that's great. Right.
Wow.
To me, that's a beautiful come full circle thing. But, yeah, we do attract a lot of newbies and people who hear about us in the news and stuff like that. But we also attract a lot of disillusioned people from other churches, which I don't know. Sometimes you feel like you've got to apologize, right, for that kind of stuff. But it is people who kind of gave up on the church, kind of coming back. And so they do have that background in the biblical training. But the big challenge in this is that you're introducing a whole new book, and in many ways, a whole new book alongside this amazing book that's not being read enough. And is the ask too big, and is it possible? But the rewards are so high. Like, we're not a big church. We're maybe 150 people. And those who are left behind are giving like crazy to keep it going. And they're investing. Our volunteer, like our level of volunteerism is like 80% of the congregation volunteers in at least two places, right? So people are committed, those who are there. But I keep waiting for God to pull the trigger or something. Send us 50 people, will you? So that we can not be always on the edge of this, but it feels like
I don't know any other church pastor that feels that way.
Describe the entire Sacramento church planning movement.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you think about, I mean, nobody knows. It's always funny. Critics come in and say, "Well, I can tell you what's wrong with your church." It's like the pastor can tell you a lot more what's wrong with his church than the critic can. So what's I mean, you're kind of starting a movement. I mean, you're, that's kind of sounds like what you hope to do. What do you need in your church now for your next, you know, what do you need next in your church? I mean, you've got this down.
Yeah.
And you're working it. And
yeah.
It's fruitful, it's and you feel this is God's call in your life.
Yeah. And I'm 51, and I'm going, okay, maybe 20 good years, really, John, probably 10. No one's going to listen to a 60-year-old anymore on this stuff.
I'm hoping it.
Okay, no, I'm hard on myself that way, but I feel, and I answer this not just for New Hope Church, right? Like, we've often, a member who wanted to leave but didn't, he's been around since, said, about 8 years ago, he says, I get the idea. It's a true idea. I don't know if you can build a church around this idea. I feel like we're doing something. We're a little petri dish experiment that's good for our church and good for the larger church in Calgary and maybe good for the church in general. And maybe you write a few books and an idea gets spawned that ends up influencing the church in such a way that a lot more churches do this 5 times a year or start to engage creation in a more expectant way. And so that may be the answer for New Hope, but the urgency I feel right now is I want to work with leaders. I want to find a whole bunch of pastors that want to do this together. Like, and the guys in Calgary and women are, they're doing it to varying degrees, but nobody wants to collectively get together. And I've learned that the best way to do this is just to sit down with each other and live in community, exegeting emergency medicine. And spend time with the doctors and the pastors. And the reason I'm in trouble with the seminary is because I've been poking that bear for a long time and wanting them to say, let's create a course on, you know, not even part of the degree, but just a course that gives pastors a chance to look at the idea of preaching both books and some tools with which to do that. And there's no room for that. So I feel this huge urgency within our church to develop preachers. Even as I say that, maybe you don't have to develop preachers. Maybe you just develop scientists and engineers and
landscapers. Your bias almost cuts against the heart of what you're doing.
The bias cuts against Sunday attendance. When you can know God through examining the mountaintops, right? Or through skiing.
You need to do a sermon on this. On being a preacher.
There's a meta sermon.
And preaching.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that really struck me this morning, though, is in our church in January, our emphasis was on evangelism. We preached on it, we taught on it. And what we learned is that evangelism is making relationships with people in your life, right? Building those kind of relationships. And every one of us said, that's the hardest thing to do. That's the hardest thing to do. And the beauty of the Reformed faith is we take special revelation so seriously. But we have in our minds said God is relevant in the Bible. And so that's why it's hard for me to build a relationship with my neighbor, because how can I convince him God's relevant right here in this Bible? And what you're doing is you're showing us in the church how to show other people, my neighbor, that God's relevant in what he's doing right now.
Already in their life.
Already.
And what you're passionate about.
And it makes our job to build a relationship with them so much easier when we can help them see how God's already relevant in their life.
Yeah.
I mean, it changes this whole missional approach to dealing with people outside the church.
And if I were going to respond to that, Dave, I'd say, what you described is not the Reformed version of it. It's a misinterpretation of the Reformed version of it, right? I mean, I think what John's giving is a corrective in giving a healing of it, because Reformed people have always had this big view of creation. All the Christians on the planet, Reformed people should have one of the highest views of creation, one of the highest views of value of what their neighbors do. And because of that, ought to be able to lead and not say, you know what's wrong with you? You're a sinner. Uh-huh. But instead say, you know what's right about you? You understand beauty as an artist. And can we, you know, let's just talk about, right? That's a starting, like.
You're so much like God, that way.
Right? I mean, you start with what's good as opposed to just start finding what's wrong with people. I mean, right? If I think about Jesus in the New Testament, the people he dogs on are the super uber religious people, the regular pagan run around sinning people. He doesn't say, here's a boatload of stuff wrong with you. Mm-hmm. He starts with their beauty. I mean, there's a friend I have in San Francisco. He's talking to a young woman who's volunteering like crazy in San Francisco. And he says, I can't go up to her and say, here's five things wrong with you. You're a sinner. You're hell-bent. You're in rebellion. Mm-hmm. Instead, he says, you know, so-and-so, I just love what you're doing. You are, you know, my view of you is you are serving in the kingdom. You are loving the kingdom. You love everything about the kingdom. I'd like to, you to get to know the king. Hmm. Right? It's just a whole different framework of
We should be able to do that, Kevin. I agree. I completely agree. But I think those of us, especially that have been in the Reformed faith forever, it's like, I mean,
and only the Reformed can say that, by the way.
Take the pulpit some Sunday and move it over to the side and see what happens. Well, oh, you can't do that. The Word of God is central to how we.
I guess where I'm pushing back on you, Dave, is exactly what Paul says. That's a misunderstanding of the Reformed faith, and I'm just pushing back a little bit on your language to say we Reformed people have this problem, and I'm like, well, that's a misunderstanding of Reformed, and it's not our own, it's not only our deal. So I don't want to be like uber protective of the tradition.
No.
But I just want to kind of name that reality for people who are new to the tradition to say, I don't think that's. I'm just reflecting back, saying I'm coming from a different place.
I think it's more of a tendency.
Of some. And it's significant in your experience, obviously.
In my experience.
Yeah.
And it's helpful to ask why that tendency grew.
Yeah.
Because it grew for very unreformed reasons.
Yes. It's much more fundamentalism that has made its roots in.
Oh, no question. Yeah.
But talk more about your church and your congregation and what influenced. So you're talking about, you know, you wish you'd have more. If you could hire a staff person to do one thing and say, here would be the next, like, development of our church, what would it be?
Got a lot of rich oil guys in Calgary, right? Mm-hmm. So if there were something clear, I would find the funds make the ask.
Yeah.
There's sort of two facets to who we are as a church organizationally. There's kind of our local community, which is our 150 people and trying to be a church together. And then there's our web-based presence and it's kind huge, of the book stuff, which is huge. In 2010, and we don't measure hits because they don't mean anything, but watches and listens. So people actually hit the button and watch. Some of our channels, you can actually tell if they watched the whole thing and finished it, and that counts as a watch. So on our smallest channel, Vimeo, last year, 10,000 people watched full sermons. So that's more than came to our church. On all of our channels, in 2010, 550,000 people. And then 2011, 750,000. And last year, 950,000 people. So, and we can track where they're coming from, and it's all English-speaking worlds. And so it looks like they're actually real people who are listening. They're not giving a cent to the church, but they are listening.
So
part of me wants to build that.
Right.
Like, I would love to build a virtual church or something, or just something, because that gives legs to an idea, and, like, I'm worried that enough people haven't grabbed onto this, or I think quit New Hope and invest in writing. I'm glad I'm here, and it was a God thing to be here, but this is my writing week, and 3 out of the last 6 months of writing weeks have been derailed, not derailed, but just had to be deferred because of different things. And I feel this huge urgency to, like, articulate and get it down, because what I've learned through Metallica is you can get an idea out there into a lot of places, and right, and it can be well formed and thought out. And so I think writing, more room to write, would be great. But I can't leave the local body to go and do that. I always say at New Hope, we're screwed, because I can never get a call anywhere else, and you guys can never find somebody who's going to do what we're doing. Like, we're together till the end, and you laugh at that, but that shouldn't be entirely true.
Right.
We should be able to. So to increase preacher capacity to enter into this worldview more, I feel a huge passion and would do anything if there's a right thing. And I probably tried to push into things too hard and too quickly, like seminaries and places where it just, like, people aren't even ready to have that dialogue. So I'd be open to any wisdom on how that can happen or ideas around that front.
If I could kind of add, I mean, I feel your pain. Our situation's been very
it's different, but it's similar in that when I tried to launch a church based largely on this premise, and one of our distinctives is from the start has been taking, in our case, it's usually songs, but using that as a second text to communicate gospel truth to people. And, I mean, everything that you're saying you've had difficulty with, we've had difficulty with as well. I mean, I can't get a solid, established Christian family to come and participate in our church because they hear a Beatles song and they're like, that's it, I'm out of here. I'm not looking for a church, you know, that's going to talk about a Beatles song or play a Beatles song, God forbid, you know, in the middle of your service. And same thing, though, I've noticed we have a lot of people.
Everybody's pointing at Aaron.
Well, which song was it?
Eleanor Rigby.
Ah, perfect. And, I've got a great Eleanor Rigby sermon. But I also noticed the flip side to that is we have a much better web presence. Our web presence is probably 10, maybe 20 times larger than what we get on any given Sunday. And they don't give at all, but that people, I mean, I have people that, you know, send me emails and call me when our YouTube videos haven't been uploaded yet, saying, you know, like, did you preach another one? Where is it? You know, people that watch that all around the country. So I see the value in the legitimate ministry aspect there, but for us, the biggest challenge comes back to one of viability, like, how do you survive being able to, you know, to do that? I mean, there's a sense where you need, you know, solid, stable, giving Christians to be able to support yourself on the home front. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that if you don't have that, that there's not a much larger legitimate ministry happening. And, you know, how do you navigate through that challenge? I mean, I could do church on the home front differently, but I don't feel called to move in that direction. I mean, you know, I that's just part of who I am. And, you know, in my giftings, I couldn't see myself, you know, no offense to other churches that do it, you know, a way that actually works.
John, where does the church fit in your theology?
Good question.
What is the church?
Because, I mean, I was very interested.
Wondering what he wants me to say.
I mean, you made the turn. Well, they don't have to come to church to see God. They go see it out there, which I think is the second part I agree with. But the question is, what is the church in your theology? Where does it lie? What is its purpose? What is the church for?
Yeah, it's a community in relationship with each other and relationship with God. It's a microcosm, a foretaste of the eventual community, of the made new community.
What's your role in that?
I'm trying to think of what your words were from your blog on this a while ago.
we have in front of us two of the most widely read bloggers in a lot of Reformed circles, actually. Reformed used loosely with John's. But, right? I mean, I don't need to ask, right? It's true. It's pretty interesting.
What are you getting at?
Well, to me it seems you're helping people see God everywhere.
Yeah.
Traditionally in our culture, the church is the place you go to meet God. Yeah. Now you're busting out the walls.
Yeah.
So you can meet God everywhere. Well, I got a lot of New Agers who are saying, I go into the Yosemite and I meet God. I say, yes, you do.
Yeah.
But now, so then that leads into the question then, what is the church? What is it for, and what is your role then within that? Because obviously you and the church are pretty tight.
Yeah, it's to me, our church is a hothouse place where people can experience in multiple places, eclectic ways, glimpses of God's voice, hear God speaking in everywhere, and a kind of a theological primer and equipper and Bible teacher kind of place. That's what our church is.
Well, that's interesting, though, because, again, because when I look at, say, your approach to the traditional approach says, teach them the Bible, and they'll put on the lenses and be able to see the world. And what we're hearing is that they're learning the Bible, but they're not putting on the glasses and seeing the world.
Right.
You're saying you need to put on the glasses and see the world, but then we also need to to thicken up those glasses and help you really focus.
Yeah. And correct. And today, believing that the fact that we've connected so much of Scripture, albeit less than another church would cover in a year, so relevantly into people's lives in so many places, that somehow, you know, who was it who said, if I could get some Christians to actually, live out 10% of what they believe, I'd change the world. I forget the guy who said that quote. And in my mind, the smaller chunks of Scripture that we are attaching to creational texts are being levered out into people's lives and having more efficacy in terms of shaping them than a dull, boring, disconnected, non-connected message. I don't mean that, because I preach those. I preach on the Ten Commandments this spring. I'm preaching just the commandments, you know, and I'm not doing anything.
So here's what I'm hearing, is that on one level, you're struggling against the denomination that you represent at some level, that the church has reached a certain number of individuals, and that when the change took place, I forget what the figure was, half of them left. And all that's the history. What I'm wondering is, as the pastor of the church, under whatever methods that you use to pastor that church, are people getting saved?
Yeah.
And so how do you facilitate that? Through the, I understand that your methods, but
yeah.
Do you use an altar call?
No.
Okay, when you say yes, how do you know that to be true?
People tell you stories that has happened in their life.
Do you have decisions and baptisms?
We do baptisms, of course, and professions of faith.
How do they go through that process?
Like, is there a class or something?
How does someone?
Yeah, we ask people. You know, right now we're going through a process where we're basically going to a whole bunch of people and we're wondering how they're doing and entering into a conversation. And some of them are young people in the church. Some of them have been around for a couple of years. We've been a little remiss in terms of making the ask. I think our postmodern tendencies are very, again, the whole altar call thing, and that side of the methodology of getting to that place. But I think have come to realize, well, you got to ask once in a while and give people a chance to respond. So we're in the middle of doing that, but not within the message. I am a big believer in preaching, as you can probably figure out, right? And I know not all churches agree, but the history of preaching in our tradition is to understand it as that you create these moments of exhortation, where somehow through the foolishness of preaching the gospel, God's presence, like God is known to be present in that place. And those moments, I mean, what is the church? It's when 150 souls at New Hope on a Sunday morning, and we all of a sudden, the veil is pulled back, and we're talking about the group of seven, but we're not anymore. The juxtaposition of all those paintings with survey of all of Jesus's parables became like we were all transported in a way, like God, the Lord was the Lord in that place, and we all kind of knew. Now, don't ask after, did anyone really have a good time or feel God's presence here? Or come on up to the front.
But that's one of the things that strikes me, John, is you have a super high view of preaching. Like if you were going to say, do a little minute or two on, here's how much time I spend on preaching.
Yeah.
Here's what some of the process is. Because one of the interesting things is this idea of team preaching, team teaching, is not pretty common. I mean, is it 1 + 1? Is it the other people preach and then you preach a second half ish,
yeah,
or is it
no,
more like it's
no.
it's a tandem
no.
kind
no.
of thing? It's
yeah.
that's what
and
I'm
it's
hearing.
Not
it's
always
right.
I most of them I do
yeah.
with input from people, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people just want to be anonymous in the input, right? So
yeah.
I just say...
Your hairstylist may say, I don't want to stand in front of 150 people freaking
no,
me right out.
But you can
yeah.
talk about the things I talked about.
Yeah.
But time-wise, it varies. These Canadian artists, a group of seven, a two-week series, and I put in probably 60 to 65 hours for two sermons.
Yeah.
So read two books, that thick from scratch, right? So the Monday, I don't know anything about these guys.
Yeah.
And start on Monday morning reading, and I'm just going, oh my, I'm a slow reader. And there's no way I'm going to get through this book. We've gotten to the point now where my wife, who's a very fast reader, knows what I'm looking for and will be a reader for me. When you include the geophysicist in the process, well, that takes away a lot of the pressure to be a geophysics expert, especially if he talks about it or she talks about it during the sermon. But even if they don't, they've given you stuff that you know is gold. You can trust these points, right? I will, with the science ones, where I felt very much on thin ice, go through that group discerning process with the scientists and theologians and figure out the sermon. I actually ran the sermon by that guy in particular. Said, read this thing. Are you okay with it? Am I using the right words? This is the big fear when you preach these creation texts, that you say something about physics, which is totally stupid. Or you just don't use the right kind of language. But yeah, I'd say 30 hours on a kind of brand new songs, like if I preach Mumford & Sons or Arcade Fire or Rush or Supertramp or whomever, music is fast now, like almost 10 hours with music, because the sensus divinitatis is so clear, and it's easy to pick it up, and they're fast. Movies are fairly fast right now. They weren't at first when we did Lord of the Rings. That was so much work. But now they're coming more quickly. These work ones are killer. Science was fairly killer in terms of time as well. And I don't know what the next genre is going to be in terms of which creational chapter we're engaging. But it seems to me that certain chapters require different levels of work and exegesis. And that may be a reflection on my... Like, I like music, right? So I feel more confident there.
And if you had to take us through, like, start, I don't know, maybe like September, and say what you kind of general, I mean, not week by week, but kind of generally what your preaching schedule thematically was, and then kind of take us into the summer, like, where's it going? You know, like, give us a big picture. Give us kind of like the helicopter view of your
preaching schedule.
Yeah.
From January until August, I'll be preaching all of the Ten Commandments, one a month.
Right now.
One a month. Does that give me enough months? A couple of months, we got two in there. Probably in the summer because I've preached the Ten Commandments before, then I can rely on the research from the older sermons. So once a month on the Ten Commandments, once a month a work-based sermon, because we're on this work kick. So we've been doing that for about a year. So just pick a different job. Once a month. Once a month on a cultural, pop cultural topic, usually as they come up kind of thing. So I got a Life of Pi I'm preaching on, a documentary film called Searching for Sugar Man. I don't know if anyone's seen that. That's brilliant. What a story. What a brilliant story of your life's work being seen, even though you didn't know it was being seen and valued. It's powerful. So once a month on a pop cultural thing, and then once a month just a straight up biblical passage, and that varies.
And how do they connect? That seems kind of so. You're doing the Ten Commandments, but over 10 months.
Yeah, it's
and
no.
No. They don't connect. Here's what we're doing today.
They do in the doing. I'm finding brilliant. Like, I just spoke about idolatry, and now I'm doing this cultural thing, and wow, who knew? I didn't know that. I sat down with our staff and said, okay, what do we want to talk about? What do we need to talk about? Ask the leadership team, are there things we need to address as a community?
Yeah.
They never say anything, so we kind of have carte blanche to pick topics. It used to be based on what came up in my life. Or people came to you with, right? And you'd have a conversation, and you just go, "Whoa, I got to preach that." And you kind of just know that you have to do that. But now we're just kind of picking topics and trusting it's there. It used to have to present itself first, the God truth, before I'd have the confidence to put it in the schedule. Now we're just putting it in the schedule.
And knowing something will be there.
Something is always there. And have not had to dump something because nothing ever showed up.
Are people consciously kind of tracking, oh, this is the work Sunday, this is the pop culture Sunday?
And choosing to come on one and not the other. Because I'm not into Supertramp, but I am into Life of Pi. I know, it's this whole consumer thing, right? But one transition that's happened as a result of moving from a seeker-sensitive church to this church with a pretty clear and, I think, compelling vision is that we've dropped the whole politeness thing. If you're on board, get on board, volunteer, support this thing. And I am more, you know, I would never do that 10 years ago. And now we're just saying, come on, folks, like, let's go. This is too good, too big. There's no excuses. Get involved.
How much can your people articulate what you're doing? That varies, I'm sure.
When I was ready to quit in the fall, pushing back with the seminary, my leadership team blew me away. They said, one guy in particular, a young guy, said, you got to stop this questioning. He said, we know what we're doing here. And this is very, and he articulates the vision, and everybody else is kind of nodding as though it's a fait accompli. And what are you doing having all of these doubts?
Why are you worried about these people?
Why are you worried about this, right? Like, yeah. And so I would say at the leadership level, strong ability and capacity to articulate. And then, yeah, like any church, it kind of has you levels. But people who are regular attenders, yeah, they get it, whether they can articulate it or not. Hearing myself say that, though, sometimes I'm surprised by people who I thought, the investment banker who I thought, when we had our conversation, he was doing all the math I was doing, and he listened to the sermon I preached on his job. And then 2 months ago, he said something that was, yeah, you go to work to make money, to give to the, like one of those things, money to the church. Like, he, I don't know, it's like it just went over his head.
Do you think your method makes people less self-righteous than kind of a traditional moralistic or biblicistic model?
You have to be more humble when you engage the rest of the world if you believe that God is speaking there. So yeah, way less self-righteous, way less bibliolatrous, way less denominationolatrous, way less church versus the world. And I don't know what's scary is that you've taken out these traditional boundaries and you haven't got the other ones in yet. Mm-hmm. And so what will this mean? Will people become heretics or go off the deep end? And
I got a question for you. You talked about wanting to push into seminary to have to teach pastors how you do what you do. What else have you done to try and train others? Because you're saying you, of course, want to not be the solo leader of doing this.
Yeah. Yeah, this is that push is about maybe 18 months in the kind of growing in me. So the seminary was the first and natural
right.
place for me to go. I tried to contact the New Begin people, and they don't know who I am, and I don't know, you know, we were talking earlier whether or not this would fit them. I've had people, when I talk to chaplains within the denomination, I mean, all the chaplains, they're totally drinking the Kool-Aid on this, right? I mean, they're in university, they see this as, and I mean, Calvin College is drinking the Kool-Aid on this. We're teaching this kind of stuff. The problem with what we're doing here is we're bringing it into the pulpit. We're okay having this Reformed worldview in our colleges and to have it as some abstract thing that we know cognitively regarding our work, but do not take up Sunday morning time doing what you're doing and going that far. So
I mean,
the chaplains say...
Have you done, like, workshops or...
Well, I thought about that, yeah.
Your process?
Yeah, I once posted something on my highly read blog. I didn't get much feedback. Josh said he'd come.
And he's here.
And he's here.
Not yet.
Yeah, I think that is something I'm going to have to... maybe try again in earnest. I really did think the seminary would look at this, a denomination that's bleeding, you know, that
right,
our number...
Right, of course it goes against what...
I know.
I think so. I mean, most of the time in university, they want to challenge you as a young adult. They want to challenge you to think to be outside of the box. But I don't know if with seminary, they're willing to do that as much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you have something that's outside of the box... and we don't know if it's going to bring the results we want, are we willing to train new people to be exposed to this because we don't know the results, and that's scary.
No. Yeah, it's out of control.
Mm-hmm. So what are the results that we want?
From? this way of being church?
Yeah.
All I want is to know him more. And I want more people to know him. I don't care about the numbers. I do care. I do care that, like I, you know, like all of us, right? You get to these high points in your city or where you can see a lot of them, and you just go, why aren't, you know, look at all these people. They don't know their right hand from their left. Lord, what's going on? So I do want that with all my heart, but I, knowing God.
So please forgive me if this sounds disrespectful. I do not mean it to be so. But is your method better than try and true? Is it any better?
I get corrected all the time on this because I communicate about it in a way and am passionate about it in a way that conveys that I think it's the best way in order to know God. If I cannot think of a better, all-encompassing, whole life including way of knowing and experiencing God than entering into the possibility that God is speaking to you everywhere all the time and you're meant to live that way. I can't think of a fuller... Now, whether it has to happen in our unique way through pop culture and all the different texts that we're engaging, maybe there's another way to do that, right? Through iconic traditions where you're knowing God. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't have to be as eclectic as what we're doing. Like, we're really shotgunning it, right? Maybe if we just narrowed it down. If we just stuck with pop culture, I think our church would be bigger and healthier because people like shooting that pop culture sermon candy stuff. They do. People love that all the time. Those are always the busiest, right? But you got to learn God at work. So eat your...
Eat your veggies.
You know, as educators, we always say that the best learning happens when you can relate the new idea to something that's relevant.
Yeah.
And so when you're talking about pop culture and work, it's relevant to people's lives. So when you can make something new, which is biblical, tie to something they already know, well, learning is more likely going to happen.
Yeah. It's closer for them, right? And pop culture is more ubiquitously known, so people know that text. A lot of people love that movie or that. So there, it is. It's closer. Whereas,
and when you tie it to your work, it is something that you know you're doing every day.
Yeah.
You have a even if I don't know what an electrician does, if you explained it to me, I can make those connections.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can transfer God in an electrician's work to my work.
This is what our church does. What she just said is what people in our church are doing all the time. Now, our church is, you know, downtown church. It's lots of university people and business people, right? It's a fairly affluent community. So it may be, and not that, no, that's not entirely true. The mechanics and the others, but there are people who can think abstractly, who can do that math that you just did. That is what we're building, a community filled with people who can do that. Who don't have to say, because I'm not into basketball, I'm not coming on that Sunday. Or...
Yeah. But I think that for me, that connection, being in the workplace, the connection that you create with creation and seeing God in all of creation, is much easier to talk to somebody about at work about that than knowing a boatload of scripture and talking about the sermon on Sunday and trying to relate that to them. It's a much easier approach for me anyway to go from the creation side, and whether it's engineering, bearings, whatever, but to come from that side that God's everywhere. And then, and my kids are disenfranchised with religion today because they're tired of hearing all the sermons and it doesn't connect to their life and their friends' life. So that it's a time thing that's happening. There's only 150 because as time grows here, I at the churches, we see it today, and as we preach today, from whether we're CRC, RCA, is its relevancy, as in the format it's in, seems to be coming to a smaller and smaller group of people as boomers and older die off. And our kids are like, I mean, just check any church. I mean, the statistics are horrid, the number of young kids, because we keep preaching the same format.
Yeah.
So I'm... it's interesting to hear a whole different approach of how to bring the relevancy of the scripture and of God into the world. So
it's not, you know, that's part of it, right? But on the knowing God side of it, part of me thinks, what are we doing not listening to half of what God's saying?
Mm.
Half, whatever. I mean, the article I wrote for Perspectives, I entitled Engaging the Whole Counsel of God, which would piss off people at seminaries, because the whole counsel of God means the whole Bible. It doesn't mean the Bible and creation. But
but the Bible,
so, to your point, sometimes I think
the Bible doesn't have creation in it, right? So,
yeah.
So
the Bible is general revelation written down.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly how I see it. So I think I have a couple questions, but the one that is in the front of my mind is, so why do you need the extra time that you take and all the energy that you spend in the extracurricular text? Why do you need to do that if within the Bible it is quote-unquote self-contained? And then the other question is I understand about church and edification, but one of my questions was, and this does not speak directly to, I'm interested in numbers, but the numbers that you have, 150, your number, over a period of time, is it growing? So are the people taking what you're trying to give to them and reaching out to somebody else and say, hey, listen, come to church with me. I have something here that's different for you. And it's made an impact in my life. And it's not religion, quote unquote, right? It's not that I'm going to hell. So is that working in your church? Because I'm really interested in that kind of a church.
Yeah. The Bible has everything we need to know about salvation.
Yes.
I don't think the Bible has everything in it that we need to know about God.
Okay.
I think there's a lot more that we can know about God, the nature of God, the attributes of God, that may not specifically be dealt with or as fully dealt with or via this particular language dealt with in the Bible.
Oh, you're saying God's bigger than Genesis to Revelations?
It's a mystery as to why the church numerically isn't growing more, and a lot of that, like people do, there are stories, anecdotal stories about people inviting, and a lot of people are really stoked, you know, I'm flying here and I'm sitting beside a young girl from Sydney who just quit Price Waterhouse and burned out as an auditor there, and they chew through their people, and she's looking for an answer, and I'm talking to her about God's truth in accounting, and you know, she lives near Calgary, and something will happen from that, but I've certainly learned to let go of expecting something. Why hasn't she called? that happens all the time.
Yeah.
But I've really had to let go of the expectation of what the results are going to be of this, while still holding on to this huge desire for more and more people to be involved. But I wish I had a clear answer. I mean, if this church it was like 2,000 in Canada, which would be a mega church in Canada, then we wouldn't get as much heat. But there's something very right about this staying just big enough to make it and to flourish. We're flourishing still as a small community and growing together. And it just having to trust and to kind of hang on the edge of that. And I am increasingly comfortable with that, which is...
If you had 1,000 people at your church, the way people looked at you and would take notes from you would be significantly different.
Oh, I'd start believing in myself.
It'd be really difficult to be humble. Anyway, that'd be a whole other story, wouldn't it? I mean, it would change everything about the equation.
I don't know that I could be the leader that I would need to be to have taken this as far as it's gone. Had success in those terms come early.
You would not have had this conversation, it seems to me,
that
we're heading. And frankly, we wouldn't have invited you.
Because you would be a different person.
Because my faith
saying
something
about us. Our fee would be higher, and you would still be in that little immigration office over there. Hey, we said that we're going to end this section at 2, so it's past that. So I just, in terms of respecting time, I just want to maybe something to close like this. John, when I saw you having a conversation with Dave. So Dave comes up and says to John, after the first session, I don't know, I'm here. Dave's one of the brightest guys I know. But he's like, basically, my job is killing me. It's just ripping me apart. And I see this person of faith, longtime faith, I see God nowhere in my job. I can't see him anywhere in the job. And I think he experienced healing today, didn't he? Didn't he experience healing? So, you know, how God works at your church, just people come up the aisle when you sing the song kind of stuff. But there's just that's just a small window, it seemed to me, into stuff that happens all the time. Paul said one of your accountant friends or friend of a friend, husband of a friend, best husband said, listening to the accounting sermon changed everything. Everything about how I think about myself and what I do. It's profound. There's for sure, I mean, among all the other things, knowing God, enjoying God forever, all those kinds of wonderful kind of conceptual things, there's personal healing that's going on, which is pretty profound. We'll just let people mingle a little bit if they want, but just so we kind of mark the time and honor the time we talked about ahead of time. You're not going away right now, right? So we'll hang out for a little while. But just anybody who does have a time schedule, time sensitive, you're here till tomorrow. We'll talk about that sermon. You don't have to read the Bible anyway.
No, tomorrow. No, this one is written that way. So.
Okay. Well, you're not very flexible.
he really isn't. I noticed that.
You're noticing that? He's like script kind of guy.
Yeah, script.
He's sections.
You watched it?
Well, yeah, because I was trying to figure out when to change the slide. I was like, oh, you're there already.
It's because you were so caught up in
it.
It's the third level.
Yeah.
All right, you guys. You're free.
That can be a prayer. Come on, Kevin.
Yeah, let's pray
for us.
Let's pray.
Yeah.
All right. Set up. We're going to pray for you.